Rated R. It contains violence, adult language, nudity, and adult content.
Good evening, everybody, and welcome. It's 11 p.m. Eastern Time, Wednesday, August 4th, 2021, and thank you for joining us for the 114th episode of the Rock and Roll Shrink Radio Show here on Blog Talk Radio. Special thanks to our host, NDB Media. I'm Casey Shapiro, and with me tonight is Dr. Stephen Mathis, a.k.a. the Rock and Roll Shrink. We will be taking calls from our listeners all evening during the show at 914-338-0314. You can also follow along in our live chat room on blogtalkradio.com as the show is happening. Before we begin, a couple quick disclaimers. This show does not constitute a doctor-client relationship, nor legal or medical representation of any kind. Also, the views expressed on this show are those of Dr. Mathis and Ms. Shapiro and are not an official stance on behalf of the psychological community or its peer vetting or regulatory bodies. Okay, now a topic-relevant bit of music played by Dr. Mathis himself. Take it away, Doc. I'm getting all caught up in the music and almost forgot to play my little wave there. As always, thank you for that. And if you don't mind, please let us know the name of the song and the artist and its relevance to tonight's topic.
Well, that one's easy because once again, I, as is somewhat common for me, it is a shameless self-promotional ploy. That's a song I wrote quite a number of years ago called Rise in My Levi's.
Oh, dear.
And
God.
The story
okay.
behind right, and the story behind that is that we were doing a gig, and the bass player I was with, we were taking a break, and this rather attractive waitress walked by, and he was looking at her, and he looks over at me, and he goes, "Oh my God, that puts a rise in my Levi's." And I thought, "Oh my God, that's a song." And a couple of weeks after that, I came out with the song. And since we're talking about sex tonight, I thought this was a good entree to our discussion on sex addiction.
All right, so let's talk about sex. Now, that's a different genre, but okay. All right, as Dr. Mathis mentions, tonight's episode is entitled One Way or Another, Sex Addiction, parenthetically CSBD, with a nod to the Rolling Stones. No, that's not true. That should be Blondie. I beg your pardon. I did not change that, and shame on me, because One Way or Another is definitely not the Stones. We did that last time. So we'll discuss these things in a moment. While I'm correcting my boo-boo, if you don't mind, before we begin, let's go to the Rock and Roll Shrink Recalls, which is a moment of rock music trivia stories as recounted by Dr. Mathis, if you would, sir.
So tonight's trivia is about an amplifier that most people have never even heard of, and probably if I weren't a music trivia freak and a Beatles freak, I wouldn't know about, and a Zeppelin freak, I wouldn't know about this either, because this is an amp that has been used by both bands back in the day. So since recently we've had the 50th anniversary of one of my all-time favorite records, Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band, I thought this would be a good time to talk about the amplifier that they used during that time period. Well, the Beatles have used a bunch of different amps during the day, and I would love to say that, you know, this is due to the fact that they had great ears and went through a bunch of amps and said, hey, we like that, we're using that. Most of the amps they used were actually just given to them, either by the amp companies or by their manager, Brian Epstein, and went, hey, you guys need these. So somebody had a good ear. And anyway, most people know the Beatles from an amp perspective, particularly in the early days by their Vox AC30s and a variety of other boxes, as well as in later sessions like during the White Album and Let It Be, and in some cases parts of Abbey Road using more Fender type amplifiers. And they would sometimes flip back and forth. However, the amp I want to talk about tonight is an amp that both they used and Zeppelin used, I think, on Led Zeppelin II in the studio. And that is a Vox, but it is a Vox UL-730, which has sort of become synonymous with the Sgt. Pepper's era because it was most notably used up there. It was also used for Revolver, which is the record that preceded Sgt. Pepper's. So the amp was a hybrid and probably one of the first hybrid ever done. And, you know, a lot of people are now starting to go, you know, when the 80s came about and people started getting all this digital stuff, folks started going digital and then they abandoned the tube stuff and then they realized how sterile the digital stuff went. And then a lot of people went back to the tubes, but then some people decided they were going to do hybrids, which would be preamp of a tube and an amp powered by transistors or somehow vice versa. This is sort of the first one of those back in the day, and it's actually been dubbed the Sgt. Pepper amp because nobody has ever, when you say Vox UL-730, they go, huh? And if you go to the Vox Sgt. Pepper amp, they go, oh. But most people don't, even the people who know that, don't know that it was a one of the first, very first hybrid amps back in the day. So it was part transistor and part tube. And it was so, the Beatles really loved it. And in fact, Paul loved it so much, he was playing as a Rickenbacker bass. Because at that point, he had gone from playing a Hofner violin bass to playing a Rickenbacker, which everybody calls a Rick, a Rickenbacker bass, which he played during the Magical Mystery Tour and Sgt. Pepper era and part of the White Album. And it would flip back and forth later years, but that and the Rickenbacker and the Hofner. So he liked the Vox amp so much he was playing his Rick through it in the studio instead of the big Fender bassman he was using at the time. So anyway, the 730 was recorded a lot using that amp. But, McCartney also used a Selmer amp for some, playing a Fender Esquire and, that sort of thing. George Harrison owned one. He actually bought one. And there weren't a whole lot of these things made. And actually, George Harrison's UL-730 went up for auction several years ago. And at the last minute, like 2 days before the auction was supposed to fly, somebody in his camp withdrew it. So I'm not sure what the deal that was, but they withdrew it from the auction and nobody knows where it is at this point. So everybody's assuming that the Harrison estate still has it. At any rate, the person who made the Vox AC30, which is, Brian May's amp and a bunch of people's amp, that's a very, very popular amp. The guy that was sort of the father of that amp, his name was Dick Denny, who was one that sort of voiced the AC30, which has just become a very classic amp. And I own one. It's really fabulous. It's the one I have has been hand-wired with AC, with the Alnico Blue speakers in it. It's the bomb, but I digress. but Dick Denny got real interested in sort of being part of this project of the 730 to sort of help Vox kind of get a little more modern, even though that was, back in the late 60s, from the all-tube amplification into this hybrid kind of thing. Because prior to this, prior to 65 and late 60s, all these folks were using, exclusively all-tube, or if you were in Britain, all-valve amplifiers. And to keep up with the demand for circuits, Vox actually started working with the Thomas Organ Company to handle some of the American demands for the amplifier. Right? And so as Thomas gained power in the Vox ranks, he said, hey, let's start making some solid-state amps and doing some transistor stuff. And, of course, people were like, oh, my God. But they thought, well, hey, let's do a hybrid. And so together with them, Denny came in and started working on the UL-730, which used a solid-state preamp and a tube power section. So the power amp was tubes and the preamp was solid-state, was transistors, to try to recreate some of the warmth tone of the AC-30s, but to have sort of a snarly kind of quality to it. And I think they had four EL-34s, which are very common tubes back in the day, and they still are very, very common tubes. And they had two Celestion-type speakers, which were exactly what were in the AC-30. When the amp was released, people didn't know quite what to do with that. But it ended up in the studio at Abbey Road Studios of the Beatles, using it on Revolver and a lot of the sounds off of Sgt. Pepper. McCartney actually used lot of the 730 on a lot of the tunes and that kind of thing. And then Harrison, of course, used it with the guitar, and McCartney was playing his bass through it. So they were kind of flipping, flopping between that and a 430. So they were kind of flipping between the two. And they were doing this with the Revolver sessions as well. But the difference in the Revolver sessions is they had what was called a 7120, which is kind of like that 730, but the 7120s had, the Walser of the Vox hybrid kind of thing, had this built-in like fuzz circuit, which you can hear on the song, song on Revolver, the British version of Revolver, which included the song that was off the American release of yesterday and today, which have a song on it called And Your Bird Can Sing, which is one of my favorite Beatle tunes, and that's actually with the 7130. The other amp, 7120, excuse me, and the other amp, the other songs off the Revolver record that were used off that, which also, again, was on the British release, was She Said, She Said, Rain, and Paperback Writer. And so you, the, all of that has the 7120 with built-in fuzz circuit. And I'm not sure why they weren't used for Sgt. Pepper, except that the 7120s were a lot louder than the 730s, and it was basically 120 watts of power versus 30 watts of power. That's what the 120 means. So 7120, the 7 is a prefix, meaning it's for a guitar amp, and the 120 means it's 120 watts of power. So I think the people in the studio were, you know, probably screaming and yelling, covering their ears and going, you can't use those amps again, oh my God. And so they went to the 730, which is a guitar amp with 30 watts, just like the AC30, but it's a half tube, half transistor amp. And so it's used on a lot of the stuff on that. And so once they did that, they were using that through the whole amp, through the whole stuff. And then, of course, that eventually ended up on, it was also being used by the Zeppelin on, I think, Led Zeppelin 2. And you can hear a lot of that with a thing like the Immigrant Song with that kind of nasty kind of stuff in there. And it just sort of went by the wayside. You know, there was only actually a lot of the, I think the I can't remember how many were made originally, but I think there was close to 100, maybe 103, 102 that were manufactured, and of those, only 25 are supposed to be in existence today. So they're extremely rare amplifiers, and people are now sort of rediscovering them, and they're like, oh my God. And so if you ever see one of those up for sale, even if they're ragged out like a mama raper, they're like ridiculous amounts of money. Recently, there's a gentleman who works in conjunction with Kemper, the profiling company that make this profiler, who went in, and he actually owns one of the 730s and went in and did a bunch of Kemper profiles for the 730s, and they're really good. I've heard them. They sound really, really good. So if somebody doesn't want to pay, you know, somewhere between $8,000 and $12,000 for a 730, if they can find one, they can get the Kemper profiles, which are done really, really well. So I'm going to do a shout out to the guy doing that. And I forget what, I think his company is called BAG, that makes these profiles. And then there's a pedal company, out of Spain called Acclaim that make really good hand-wired pedals. And they have a pedal called the Dr. Robert, which of course is a song off Yesterday and Today, the American version of that, which uses the UL 730, and it's a pedal platform of the UL 730 that the pedal makers have taken and basically recapitulated the schematic of the 730 and kind of shrunk it down to pedal form. And the other added kind of cool thing about that is the Dr. Robert has the artist who did a lot of the Beatle art on their records, Klaus Voormann, who also played bass on most of the George Harrison stuff of All Things Must Pass, and has toured with him and played with him on the Bangladesh concert. Klaus is a well-known artist and musician, and had become friends with the Beatles early on, and he and George Harrison became really good friends and played a lot together. He did the artwork on the Revolver record. So he does the artwork for the Dr. Robert pedal. So it's kind of a cool deal to have that. And I actually bought one, mainly just to have it because it had Klaus Voormann's artwork on it. And that was kind of how I got turned on to the 730, because I heard the pedal and I went, well, that sounds really cool. And it doesn't sound like any other whatevers, you know, this overdrive type distortion-y kind of pedal. And then I started doing research and I went, oh, that's what that sound is, because I had never heard of these things either, and you know what a nerd I am. I mean, if I haven't heard about it, you can probably bet your bippy most people have never even heard of it. So anyway, that's how I got turned on to this originally, and then recently discovered the gentleman doing the the Kemper profiles, which is really cool. So it's his website's called Bag of Amps, which is BAG Bag. And I think the gentleman's name is Christian something or other. I cannot remember his name now. Christian Hellman. That's his name. God, I can't believe I remembered that. but anyway, that's my story. So there you have it.
There's your story and you're sticking to it, Emily.
That's correct.
Yes.
But yeah.
Okay. All right. Thank you for that very much. By the way, do you actually own one of those amps?
No, I started went on I went on the hunt for those things and I saw the prices and I was like, okay, this is for people with more money than I have strands of hair. Now, you know, having said that, if I find some guy or gal who's got one that their great, you know, their uncle had, and they're like, I don't know what this piece of junk is, and they want to sell it for like, you know, $100 or something, I'm jumping on that thing like you would a bad hooker in a very, you know, low-rent bar. But but other than that.
Looking for a metaphor to work with tonight's topic, is that it?
yes, it is. Thank you very much. I'll be here all week.
All right.
And,
okay.
But what
Thanks
I am going to do. Yeah, but what I am doing is purchasing the Hellman BAG profiles that he did because they are really stellar.
Nice. Okay. Cool.
Yeah.
All right.
Next best thing. Yeah, for us pole buckers.
Next best thing to be in there.
There you go.
Okay. All right. So let's get started. One way or another, sex addiction, CSBD. So tonight's show is about sex addiction, and I use that in air quotes, which I'm going to do a lot tonight. We've touched on this topic briefly in prior episodes. We've done episodes on addiction before in various forms, and we've mentioned this in passing, but this is a dedicated show just for this aspect. So we want to focus specifically on this condition. I said specific twice. Shame on me. That's what I get for writing scripts when I'm tired. We want to discuss various aspects of it. Most of all, the controversy within the psychological and mental health communities about its accuracy as being handled like other established addictions, such as substance abuse. So we'll also briefly cover two other loosely related pathologies, which are love and relationship addictions and porn addiction. This show in particular is about professional topics, and we will not be discussing erotica, pornography, except clinically, or other adult topics outside of brief professional references. We're not here to be titillating, no pun intended. Actually, it was. But just in case anybody's concerned about that, we are talking about adult topics, but we're not being prurient here. Okay, so what we will be discussing is, first, the clinical definition of addiction and comparing sex addiction, quote-unquote, to other addictions. Second, the diagnostic controversy around sex addiction. Next, love and relationships addiction and porn addiction in a little more detail. And last, final conclusions on diagnoses and where to get help. And before we get started, I'm going to check in with you, Dr. Mathis, see if there's anything you want to bring up before we get going.
I'm good. Thank you.
All righty. So the clinical definition of addiction and comparing sex addiction to other addictions. So let's begin our discussion by establishing exactly what is addiction. According to psychologists and the reference guides they use, mainly the DSM-5 or the ICD-11. So addiction is a chronic disorder with biological, psychological, social, and or environmental factors influencing its development and maintenance. About half the risk for addiction is genetic, the rest is other factors. Genes affect the degree of reward that individuals experience when initially using a substance like drugs or engaging in certain behaviors such as gambling, as well as the way the body processes alcohol or other drugs, chemicals. Heightened desire to re-experience use of the substance or the behavior, potentially influenced by psychological, like stress, history of trauma, social, like family or friends use of a substance, and environmental factors like accessibility of a substance, low cost, can lead to regular use or exposure, with chronic use and exposure leading to brain changes. These brain changes include alterations in cortical prefrontal cortex and subcortical limbic system regions involving the neurocircuitry of reward, motivation, memory, impulse control, and judgment. That's going to be important later. This can lead to dramatic increases in cravings for a drug or an activity, as well as impairments in the ability to successfully regulate this impulse, despite the knowledge and experience of many consequences relating to the addictive behavior. And the source for that is the APA website, adapted from the Recovery Research Institute, Massachusetts General, Harvard Medical School. This definition at first seems to encompass so-called sex addiction, again quotes, but we will further discuss some key differences, primarily in terminology and criteria, in our next segment. Next SNP is defining sex addiction, and the source is a paper called What is Sex Addiction? From PsychCentral.com. This was medically reviewed by Jennifer Littner, LMFT, CST, and written by Hope Gillette on March 3rd, 2021. And they said, though sex addiction is a prevalent term, it is controversial and often misunderstood. There's no evidence that suggests sex can be defined as an addiction or that repetitive and persistent sexual behaviors are explained by one. However, compulsive sexual behavior disorder, that's CSBD, you'll hear me say that often tonight, refers to a long-standing pattern of repetitive sexual behaviors, fantasies, and urges. The pattern of repetitive sexual activities and urges can also be explained by out-of-control sexual behavior, which is OCSB. Lots of acronyms tonight. This is a newer concept that refers to a behavioral pattern instead of a clinical disorder, as defined by Michael Vigorito, who's a sex therapist in D.C. and co-author of Treating Out-of-Control Sexual Behavior, Rethinking Sex Addiction. OCSB refers to intrusive and hard-to-control sexual urges, thoughts, and behaviors. In CSBD and OCSB, your sexual thoughts, urges, and behaviors may become the main focus of your life. This could lead you to leave other aspects of your life unattended. And I'm going to pause here and check in with Dr. Mathis a little more often than I sometimes do, because there are little snips here that are controversial and subject to interpretation, so I'd like to get him to weigh in. So do you concur with this, and is there anything that you'd like to add while we're talking about it?
Yeah, I can tell you that sex addiction is just like any other addiction, whether it's religion, relationships, gambling, food, shopping, drugs, it doesn't matter. All addictions are the same. They all come from a desire to change your brain chemistry for immediate gratification, to avoid feeling a certain way, whether it's due to bipolar disorder, ADHD, low self-esteem, low self-efficacy, depression, anxiety, cluster B personality disorders. It doesn't matter. They're all escape avoidant tools, and as I like to often say, better living through chemistry. Because any of those activities that lead to compulsivity type stuff, they hijack, and you're right about that, they hijack the limbic system, the amygdala hippocampus, and what they do is cause the brain to produce a lot of pleasure-related chemicals. And let's face it, who the heck doesn't want to feel pleasure? And it's in some people that pleasure becomes addicting. It becomes just like any other drug, because let's face it, the chemicals in your brain are drugs. Right, so whether you're talking about an external drug that you're putting into your system, whether it's sugar or caffeine or cocaine, it's all a drug. And the same can be said of epinephrine, serotonin, dopamine. Right, doesn't matter. They're all drugs. And all drugs of abuse and activities that lead to abuse tend to elicit pleasurable chemical release in the brain. And for some people, it becomes very much a compulsion that they have to do all the time because they don't feel normal. There's something missing in their life, or they have a brain wiring foobar or whatever, and they're using that as an escape avoidant tool and a self-medication tool, basically.
Okay. All right. And then lastly, I want to mention briefly for the moment two seemingly related but separate addictions. And I don't know if those are in quotes. We'll get to that when we talk, which are love and relationship addictions and porn addictions. And these are separate from sex addiction, both of which we'll discuss later. And I'm going to just pause real quick because I have it in the script and I want to give you the courtesy of another chance to say anything. Is there anything else you want to say about this section before we go to the next?
I will actually hold my comments till we get to there, but same story. I mean, it's the same story with these things. Same thing with internet addiction, right? Same story. But I'll deal with them specifically when we get there, and you can ask what you think the listeners would be interested in hearing about that.
Okay. And I know we may end up with a little bit of controversial discussion tonight because one of the main things I'm positing is that sex addiction is something of a misnomer. Not that the behaviors are not a problem, but this is kind of a terminology fight, but we're going to get to that in the next section. So the diagnostic controversy around sex addiction. As we alluded earlier, there's a lot of dissent about defining, never mind diagnosing and treating, so-called sex addiction. I put the term in quotes because now I would like to discuss pop culture definitions and how they fall short of the clear medical reality. As with numerous other pathologies we've covered on this show, laypersons picked up a flawed understanding of the condition, mostly from a combination of media and entertainment and social self-diagnosing or proclamations of definitions that are not backed by science. This in turn causes them to be unable to respond effectively to problems that arise from a mislabeled but very real condition. And this next part is from the paper that I mentioned earlier, What is Sex Addiction, from Psych Central. We don't need to go through all the credits again. There's a large chunk of my notes that are coming from there. So they say in this section, compulsive sexual behavior disorder, or CSBD, often commonly known as hypersexuality, is commonly referred to as sex addiction. However, sex addiction as a condition is not formally accepted by all members of the medical community. Though a diagnosis of sex addiction does not formally exist, technically, compulsive sexual behavior can result in significant emotional pain and other devastating consequences. Many people ask, is sex addiction a real thing, whatever that means? And we know what they mean, but it's kind of a vague way to ask it. In reality, compulsive sexual behavior goes beyond desire. CSBD involves a variety of complex and intense unwanted sexual behaviors and fantasies that at times may become harmful to you and others. The condition can be managed, though. It might require seeking the help of a health professional and committing to long-term treatment. And they say might in the article. I pretty much am willing to say if this condition is in question, I really can't see anybody not going to a professional. I think it's imperative that you at least confer with them and see what's going on. Would you agree, Dr. Mathis, with that part?
Oh, God, yeah, absolutely. And honestly, I don't care what you call it, whether you call it a compulsion or addiction, because the two things are almost synonymous.
Yeah, and I'm actually going to put you on the spot for that in a couple of paragraphs. So buckle up, Buttercup.
All righty, then.
The other thing they say in the paper is that language matters, and that's the crux of what we're talking about here. So in this article, we, meaning they, use sexual addiction, a term written about, studied, and discussed in psychology and counseling groups and 12-step programs. Still, there is no evidence to suggest that sex addiction exists. And again, this is a terminology question. This is not saying that people's problems don't exist. And be really clear on that tonight. Or that symptoms of compulsive sexual behavior may be explained as an addiction. However, this is not to imply your symptoms and concerns aren't valid or real. This clarification refers to formal terminology only. And here is the spot that we're putting you on. Well, I gave you a little warning because I highlighted it for you. So the question for Dr. Mathis is, and it's a little long, What is the diagnostic difference between an actual bona fide addiction and a compulsive behavior disorder, sexual or otherwise, both of which can mark obsessions that ruin lives? How would one distinguish between the two, or is that really an academic distinction? And then after this, I have a second question.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I really do think it's more – here's the clinical difference. So compulsive behaviors fall under anxiety disorders. So other than obsessive compulsive personality disorder, which, you know, both of us know yours truly has, that is a cluster C personality disorder. But for all intents and purposes, it's really kind of an anxiety-based disorder, even though it's not under the anxiety rubric, just like PTSD and all of its various varieties are also anxiety disorders, even though they've been pulled out into their own little category. They're all basically out of fear and what if and anxiety. So that's OCD as well. And it's also acute stress disorder, which just falls under the trauma category now, or any of the phobic disorders or any of the panic disorders, right? So all of those are really the brain kind of doing a mismatch. And the behaviors, the quote-unquote rituals that people do, whether it's counting or taking steps back or taking a leap after your third step or counting the number of steps you're doing up to a flight of stairs or having to turn your body a certain way or, putting your hand on a door handle to open it correctly or, you know, quote unquote, or whatever, they're done out of fear to avert some negative thing. But it can be very compulsive, and it looks like, and you have to do it, so it looks like an addiction, but it's technically a compulsion, which is basically, for lack of a better term, an addiction used to avert some crazy fear that never really existed, you know, condition, right? So that so to avert some horrible and terrible catastrophe that really was never questioned in the first place, right? Which is why things like phobias are, you know, aphobias, which is Greek for, you know, irrational fear, basically. So all of those are, you know, irrational belief systems. If you don't do something, something bad. So it's done to avert something. An addiction is done to produce a certain chemical in your brain to, in a sense, to avert something, but the thing it's averting is feeling bad, whether it's feeling nervous and scared, whether it's feeling depressed, whether it's feeling empty inside, whether it's feeling an impulse to act out and you want to do it so that, you know, it's a different biochemical situation, but they look very similar when you look at them in real time. And I don't really care. From a personal perspective, I don't really care whether somebody calls it a compulsive sexuality or an addictive behavior, because it acts actually, although I have to tell you, from a biochemical standpoint, it looks much more like an addiction than it does a compulsion. Most addictions, as I mentioned a few minutes ago, are done to produce especially dopamine and serotonin in the brain. And compulsive behaviors don't necessarily do that. They just calm you down from this feared event. I mean, they do involve biochemicals, and some of which are serotonin, some of which are adrenaline, and some of which are dopamine, and, you know, or whatever. But all drugs of abuse either increase dopamine directly or increase dopamine by suppressing a suppressor of dopamine. And all of the addictive behaviors like gambling and sex are done, shopping and love, although love's a little bit different, and porn and internet are all done to increase dopamine. Love does dopamine and serotonin. So you get a 2-for-1-er in that one, the relationship and the love addiction. But they're all done to increase biochemistry in the brain that you're not – seemingly not able to produce on your own, even though you are, but maybe you don't know how to do it, and maybe you just haven't, you know, gone in the right direction or whatever. But they're still producing, they're trying to correct a brain fart. And so are the compulsive behaviors. They're all trying to correct some kind of brain fart, some kind of mistaken belief system that you have. And they do look incredibly similar. So it would be easy for anybody to confuse the two.
Okay. Perfect. So with that, I have a second question follow-up.
Okay.
Our compulsive behaviors within our control to choose to stop.
Without help. Is that what you're asking?
Yeah, let's say without professional help. Is this something somebody could choose to stop?
Okay, it's like, okay, I'm done. Some people can, some people can't. The answer is it depends. And here's what it depends on, because that's the next follow-up question, right?
Yep,
it depends on, it depends on how resilient you are. It depends on your genetic makeup. It depends on how many other compulsive addictive behaviors you have on your plate. It depends on how many other co-occurring disorders you have, like ADHD, like cluster B personality disorders. It depends on how, you know, deep, you know, to quote Tapao, how deep and deflactal you have become. Because if you're really deep in it, probably not. If you're in the early stages, probably so. The problem with it is most people don't want to recognize it, even if they're, you know, to mimic a Bela Lugosi, even if in the deep dark recesses of that unconscious, they know that they're having a problem. Most people want to act in denial, and they want to say, oh, I can quit anytime I want. I'm just going to do it one more time or whatever, kind of like they do addictions. And people do compulsive behaviors the same way, by the way. And in the early stages, people lie to themselves a lot. But if they would not lie to themselves and they'd look and go, hey, look, I'm neglecting key life stuff here. Not only am I creating pleasurable mind states, you know, which in and of itself is nothing wrong with that, but if I'm doing it at the expense of paying bills and remembering my girlfriend or boyfriend's or wife's or whatever anniversary, or, you know, I'm showing up late for the job because I'm on my fifth hookup today before I get to the job because the last one took longer than I thought, right? If you're doing things that are impairing your life functioning, that clearly meets the qualifications for an addiction. That's one of the key diagnostic components. And at that point, if you catch it early, most people can quit. Well, if you catch it that early and you don't have a shoot ton of other co-occurring disorders and you have a relatively average 90 to 110-esque IQ, you can probably put a lid on your id and manage it yourself. Most people don't do that. They lie to themselves and they go, okay, well, I won't do it again. It's just one time. Okay, this is bad. I got to watch myself, and they'll kind of be good for a while, and then they slip back into the same, you know, pattern. And unfortunately, humans are, for the most part, slow learners. But you know, there's people with full-blown addictions that quit, you know, and I'm talking drugs and alcohol stuff. And most of the people who quit addictions, particularly if they started as teenagers, which most people do, they kind of mature out of it. I mean, so I forgot the exact number, and I should know, but I don't off the top of my head. But it's something like 60% people are self-stoppers. They just mature out of it. They survive it. They, you know, their lives are impacted negatively for a while, and they just kind of go, okay, this is dumb. I got to grow up and be a real adult now and do it without any professional help. But there's a large group of people who can't and don't. And the same is true with compulsive behaviors. So some people can do it, some people can't. It just depends on a number of factors. And what I tell most people is if you're concerned about, A, whether you have a compulsion or an addiction, and you're concerned about whether you think you might be able to keep it under control, go see somebody who is a certified addiction specialist and or compulsive behavior specialist. Then they can, that person can tell you pretty quickly, yep, you have diagnosed yourself correctly, and here's how you're going to put a lid on your id, right? And
gotcha.
So if you catch it early enough, it's a relatively easy fix, but it's like anything else. You know, if you let cancer go too long, you know, it's much worse treatment than if you catch it in early stages. This is no different.
Right. Okay, good. Then that confirms most of what I was asserting in that section. So
yes.
Let's go ahead and move on. Just real quick, I wanted to bring these up while we're talking about sex addiction because these two other related issues often get called sex addiction when they're not. They're separate things, and each one's a little different than the other ones in some ways. So and that's love and relationships addiction and porn addiction. So love and relationships addiction, the source had said, and the source is Recovery Ranch in Tennessee. I do take a little bit of these postings with a grain of salt because some of these recovery centers are 12-step based. We've talked on this show several times about how Dr. Mathis and I feel about that. But nevertheless, this is what they posited, and I do think it will be valuable to our listeners. And they said, love addicts are addicted to the rush of first romance. Some people, this is not from the article, this is me. A lot of people have a slang term called new relationship energy. And, you know, it's kind of self-explanatory how the relationship is when you first get there. So going back to the article, it says, because of that, their relationships never develop beyond this initial emotionally elevated state. When they're in a relationship, they feel detached, unhappy, restless, irritable, and discontent because the rush has faded. When they're not in a relationship, they feel desperate, unworthy, and alone until they find a new potential mate and get to experience the high of falling in love once more. I'm wondering if you can elaborate on that a little bit and how it's different from sex addiction, or if maybe the difference is very thin.
Yeah, porn addiction is actually a lot closer to sex addiction than love and relationship addiction is. Because love and relationship addiction is much more, oh my gosh, I haven't accepted the existential fact that I'm born alone, live alone, and die alone. And even though I get into relationships which help me assuage the existential anxiety, as Seth would say, my buddy Seth would say of all, as he calls them, boardies, borderlines, I'm one relationship away from happiness. And they're looking for solutions outside of themselves, and they're thinking that, you know, they can somehow be, you know, more complete. And if they have the other person, that's going to complete their half, and they're going to live happily ever after and, you know, walk out from the sunset. And most of those people are in love with love. They're not in love with the reality of relationships, and that relationships, like a lot of things, require that nasty, obscene, full-letter word, work. And if you don't get into a healthy relationship, it's going to be work that's going to get you nowhere except frustrated and onto your next relationship. So it's a different kind of thing. You know, it's more, I'm going to be whole if I find my, you know, whatever's, my opposite or my, you know, paramour, or as some of the Orthodox Jewish folks say, they're beshert. You know, and that's it's been ingrained in our religion. It's in not just Jewish, I mean, in all religions. It's ingrained in our TV shows. It's ingrained in our culture. I mean, if you look at our culture, it's very biased against people who aren't in relationships, whether they're married or cohabitating or whatever. We don't like single people very much in our relationship, in our society. And so I think a lot of people buy the Kool-Aid. And then some people are missing stuff in themselves, and they're looking for the solution outside of themselves. And that's a very different thing than addiction in the sense that love and relationships are more, for lack of a better term from a biochemical standpoint, much more serotonin-based, whereas the porn and sex is much more epinephrine and dopamine-based. So from a biochemical standpoint, they're pretty different. And if you sign back on, you're not coming through.
Oh, I hit my microphone. Oh, my God. Okay. So I'm going to just real quick read what Recovery Ranch said about porn addiction, even though we've partially covered that already. They said, porn addiction refers to a person becoming emotionally dependent on pornography to the point that it interferes with their daily life, relationships, and ability to function. The source for that was Medical News Today. Now, not quoting them, we on this show do not shame or condemn the use of consensual pornography by adults of legal age. We're not here to judge such things. We're only speaking tonight of persons whose use of such material becomes obsessive and or destructive in their lives, which is a behavioral disorder and not a failing of the medium itself. And is there anything else that you want to add to the porn part, Dr. Mathis?
No, I think that's pretty accurate. You know,
yeah.
And I'm glad you said that because, I'm not in here, certainly, and I know you aren't either, in here to slam love. We're not in here to slam relationships. We're not in here to slam porn. I mean, that's a personal choice that every consenting adult has to make. And none of those things in and of themselves are pathological. And neither is sex, for God's sake, right? It's the overuse and underuse that makes it, you know, not too good. And what's interesting to me is if you look in the DSM, there's a hypersexuality, you know, category in there. It used to be in the older DSM, but there was nothing in there about hyposexual desire disorder, which I thought was really interesting, which kind of goes to a little bit of a cultural bias, which I thought was like, well, that's interesting. So if you're Cleopatra, that's, you know, that, you know, that's not, you know, that's, that, that's not real good. But if you just don't want it because you're just not that interested, whoa, what the hell, you know, that's bad. You know, if you're Cleopatra and you're keeping it under wraps, that's okay. But if, you know, the hyposexual, but hypersexual, oh, my God. You know, I had that backwards originally. And I just thought that was really funny that, you know, they had a thing that if you didn't want sex enough, it was hypo. I'm sorry, I got this confused. It was a hyposexual disorder. There was a thing that said, okay, well, this is bad. You need to go get help. There was nothing in the DSM, and there still isn't anything in the DSM that says if you want it too much, there's something wrong with you. And I just think that's hilarious. So,
interesting. We may revisit this as another topic later on that raises some questions. Okay.
All right.
So,
well, there you go.
Yep. Final conclusions on diagnosis and where to get help. A source for this, again, is What is Sex Addiction from Psych Central. And in this section they said, so what causes compulsive sexual behavior? The causes of long-term, uncontrollable sexual urges and behaviors are not well understood. I would say that's somewhat subjective, but that's what they assert.
Yeah.
People of all ages may experience a condition and for different reasons. It's probable that a combination of factors leads to compulsive sexual behaviors, including, but not limited to, chemical imbalances in the brain, underlying or co-occurring mental health conditions, childhood experiences, childhood relationships with parents or guardians, and other lifestyle influences. Not all potential causes of sex addiction can be traced to trauma or underlying mental health conditions, though. Preliminary research suggests an imbalance of dopamine, a neurotransmitter in the brain, may also impact sexual behaviors. If you have a frontal lobe lesion, a tumor, or a seizure disorder, you may also have a greater chance of experiencing some hypersexuality.
Could I search something here for a second, insert something here?
Sure. Feel free.
Yes. So, for example, childhood experiences, that's really important. And we're not talking about trauma, even though that certainly impacts it. So if you look at some of the childhood experiences of some of the serial rapists / killers like, Ramirez, the Night Stalker. So he had an early influence of a relative of his, I think it was a cousin, who came back from Vietnam and talking about all the women he had tortured and raped and killed, and showed him pictures, was showing Ramirez pictures of these things, and he just thought that was a great, you know, and said, and that was where he kind of got his training of, oh, this is what women are for. And that was clearly an experience he had as an adolescent that had a major impact on him, because prior to that, he wasn't, you know, that funky. he had some of his challenges, but that was a huge impact on him. And you see some of these people in homes where, I'm working with somebody right now, for example, who is fighting the programming by this person's brother and father that this is what women are for and this is what all women should be doing. And if women aren't doing that, they're not doing their J-O-B and they're bad people and blah, 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 blah. And, of course, this is a female who has then, you know, started going, okay, well, I guess that means I have to do this and this and this and this. And when this person realized that this was like messed up. This person came to me and said, what the hell's wrong with me? And I go, y'all bought the Kool-Aid, honey. And, you know, most people who have that kind of training all through their childhood and adolescence, what else are you – that's what they're taught. You know, it's like these people that grow up in these crazy, you know, religious families, these you know, Hasidic – not Hasidic. Oh, Jesus, what do you call those crazy asses? The Al-Qaeda people, right? And some of these Jim Jones types and all these crazy people, right? They grew up in those families. They believe that crap. They're being brainwashed, in a quote-unquote, in a sense. And this person had experienced the same thing with her family. And so a lot of how that involves the child relationships with parents or guardians. What messages did they get either directly or indirectly from their parents? And, you know, aside from trauma, which obviously has an impact on stuff. So I wanted to really reinforce the childhood experiences thing, because that does play a role in some of these.
Gotcha. Okay. Yeah, I understand what you're gesturing at now. All right. So so the next thing that they said is the diagnosis of sex addiction. The diagnosis of CSBD or hypersexuality is sometimes challenging. This stems in part from the lack of consistency in fitting some of these behaviors within one mental health condition. And I don't really actually think too many people can be boxed into just one when it comes to this. So it's usually something comorbidity going on.
Yep.
All right. And they said, although excluded from the fifth edition of the DSM, compulsive sexual behavior and what many call sex addiction are frequently seen in clinical settings. Yes, we know. Like I said, primarily this is a terminology and mm-hmm. what checklist do you use for diagnosis issue or conflict here.
Right.
The decision to remove it from the manual was controversial. Yes, I'm going to point at that 100 times. Pay attention, guys. Some mental health professionals who often see it firsthand and care for people living with symptoms didn't agree with the exclusion. Because they're looking at it as the exclusion is not saying this doesn't exist. It's not saying it's not a problem. It's not saying it's not valid or it's not real. But when you call something an addiction, it brings up certain assumptions, stereotypes, procedures people follow for treatment that don't apply if it's not properly an addiction in the same way that, like, doing coke is or something.
Right.
Okay,
right.
So back to the article. Hypersexuality can still be diagnosed using the manual, though, by assigning it to the other specified sexual dysfunction category.
Yep.
On the other hand, the ICD-11 includes compulsive sexual behavior disorder as a formal diagnosis. Now, ICD-11 often catches the little things that have gotten screwed up by the DSM-5. Asperger's, I'm looking at you. So... Mm-hmm. It's classified under impulse control disorders, not addictions, which was one of the points I was poking earlier tonight. The ICD is not commonly used by mental health professionals in the United States. I know Dr. Mathis does keep it on hand because there are times when the DSM just isn't quite good enough for something.
Yep.
However, it's consulted in many instances where the DSM-5 doesn't offer specific diagnostic criteria for a given condition, such as in this case. Big surprise.
Yep, yep.
All right. What are the symptoms of sex addiction? And this is somewhat subjective, somewhat malleable. So in general, compulsive sexual behavior covers a broad array of symptoms. These behaviors range in intensity and severity, but to be considered signs of mental health condition, they have to be evident across many situations and over an extended period of time. According to the ICD-11, signs of compulsive sexual behavior disorder include, but are not limited to, and so on, a significant preoccupation with sexual fantasies, impulses, and behaviors, repetitive sexual activities to satisfy such fantasies and impulses, unsuccessful attempts at stopping or decreasing sexual fantasies, impulses, and behaviors, or experiencing distress and significant challenges in relationships, occupational activities, and other important areas as a result of the compulsive sexual behaviors and impulses. Another important aspect of compulsive sexual behavior disorder is the duration of symptoms. The ICD-11 says you need to experience sex addiction symptoms for 6 months or longer to receive a diagnosis. It's important to also keep in mind cultural differences. Feeling guilty, ashamed, or distressed about your sexual behaviors might be more common in some people than others. And this has to do with your culture or how you were raised, your community. In this
right.
case, experiencing this type of distress wouldn't by itself mean you have a sexual addiction at all. You know, if you're in a religious community, if your family or neighborhood is very conservative or very isolated, maybe you're not very sophisticated, you know, lots of different things could happen. It doesn't mean you're sexually compulsive. It doesn't mean you're an addict of any kind. You have to take these things in context. And lastly, I would like to talk about when and where to get help, but the internet is all over the place on this. So Dr. Mathis, if people are concerned about their sexual behavior and compulsions or potential addictions, when do they know they need to go get help, and where's a good place to go do that?
Okay. And in terms of cultural stuff, I'm going to be a little, like, funky, but, you know, this is different from when. Or if you're a member of the CLSD, you might not consider any of those kind of overt sexual activities as addictions.
Okay, that's fair.
Are you familiar with that? Do you know what the CLSD is? It's the religious order that Rasputin belonged to.
Ah, that's where I've heard it. Okay, it's been a while since I've seen that.
Yeah, that really is an order. I'm not making that crap up.
Yeah,
right?
No.
Okay.
No, I have heard of that, but it's been several years. So I'm like, I know why that's funny. I can't find it.
Yeah, well, there you go.
You gotta be
there,
nice.
You know.
I've had
okay.
three strokes. Okay, I have pants on. I'm having a good day. All right. So
okay, but to address your question,
if people are looking for help on this, you know, what would you recommend
yeah.
for them?
Yeah. Like most compulsive and or addictive behaviors, the treatment of choice for these things is always some form of cognitive behavioral therapy, CBT, whether it's dialectic behavior therapy, cognitive behavioral therapy, rational motor behavior therapy, anything under the CBT umbrella. Okay, so if you're going to get help from these, go to somebody who is an experienced practitioner, or even better yet, if you can find somebody in your area who's board certified, that's even better, because they've had the folks who are board certified have to go like the extra mile, so to speak, to get that qualification. And folks who are wanting to do that can look up the National Association of Cognitive Behavioral Therapists website, NACBT. I think it's .org, but don't quote me on that. They can just Google National Association of Cognitive Behavioral Therapists, and they'll go to the website, and they will have a list of all their board-certified therapists state by state. So if you're in California, if you're in Nebraska, it doesn't matter. You just go to the website, you look up your state, and you see who's board-certified in your state. So that's one way to do it. The other way is, and if you don't find anybody in your area and you don't want to do telemental health with somebody, you know, 100 miles away or whatever in your state, when you're calling for help, just ask the person, you know, what are their you know, what's their experience with sex addiction or compulsive sexuality? Do they feel competent? A lot of people who treat addictions don't feel comfortable dealing with sex, with quote-unquote sex addiction. I can't tell you how many people have approached me, other professionals, and go, hey, do you know somebody who works with sex addicts? Because I don't do addiction at all. And I know you do alcohol and drugs, but – when somebody does sex addiction, and I just kind of want to roll my eyes at them and go, dude, an addiction is an addiction is an addiction is an addiction. Okay? Hello, McFly. And then I have to explain the stuff to them, and they're like, oh. And I'm thinking to myself, and you got your degree where? Anyway, but talk to somebody who's comfortable, because even if you know that gambling and sex and porn and food and religion have a very similar origin and an etiology, they don't necessarily mean they're comfortable dealing with it. So some people don't, who are even board certified, don't deal with it. They're like, oh, that's out of my bailiwick or whatever. So just, you know, ask the important questions. Call up the office. Talk to the therapist or his or her office manager. Does Dr. So-and-so deal with addictions or compulsions? What credentials does Dr. So-and-so have? What experiences does Dr. So-and-so have? Some people won't deal with internet, I'll get it right in a minute, internet addiction. They'll do sex addiction, they won't do internet addiction. Right? So you just got to ask the questions, you know, and don't be embarrassed to ask the questions. I had a discussion with somebody a couple of weeks ago and like, well, how do I find a therapy and a therapist? And I don't want to be rude. Like, you're not being rude. This is your life. Ask questions. You're not being rude if you question their training. You're not being rude if you ask what their credentials are and their experiences are. That's being a smart shopper, right?
Yeah. That's being thorough, but a lot of people are taught to feel self-conscious about that, and they really shouldn't.
Right. What's the thing you do with a car? What's the Carfax report, right? So do you buy a car without a Carfax report? Right? Ask for the Carfax report. Ask what credentials the person has, what experiences they have, how many years have they been practicing. Those are all bona fide, reality-based, important consumer questions. I never feel insulted when people ask me that. What I do feel insulted is when people ask me things like, are you a friend of Bill and Bob's? Which is code word for, are you in recovery? The 12 steps. I'm like, no, that's not important. And, or they call in and they want you to see their kids. Do you have any kids? That's not germane to the issue. Are you married? That's not germane to the issue. Are you gay? That's not germane to the issue. Have you been saved? That's not germane to the issue. I get all those inappropriate questions. Now, if you want a Christian counselor, just come out and say, hey, do you practice Christian-based counseling? Or are you a certified Christian counselor? Yeah. Just come out and ask it. That's easy. Right?
If you're a person who wants... that, and it'll just tell you. Yeah. I mean,
right.
There's directories to that.
And if you're looking for a gay therapist, just ask for a gay therapist. Now, if you're just looking for a gay-friendly therapist, then, yeah, you want to ask that, because if you get people who are, homophobes as therapists, and there are those of us out there, you don't want a homophobe doing therapy with you. If you're, struggling with sexual orientation, that's the last freaking thing you need.
Yeah.
So just ask the questions, But in general, what you're looking for is an experienced person who knows how to diagnose addictions and compulsives. And if you're going to do therapy with them, somebody who practices cognitive behavioral therapy on a regular basis and or who is certified. You don't have to be board certified to do it, but it's, it couldn't hurt, right?
Fair enough. Okay. All right. Is there anything else that you would like to bring up about addictions before we wrap this up?
No, I think we're good.
All right. So in summary, we hope now that our listeners better understand sex addiction, or more properly, CSBD or hypersexuality. We hope that you guys have learned more about how to distinguish between unhealthy or obsessive sexual behaviors and a healthy adult sex life, and that those who may have additional issues now know where to go to get some help. Also, if you get completely stuck at any point in time, feel free to email Dr. Mathis from his webpage or message us on the Facebook page. We are happy to help you a little further if you feel like you didn't really get it all the first time. That's perfectly fine.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Okay, so this concludes our show, one way or another, sex addiction or CSBD. And in closing, on behalf of myself, Dr. Mathis, and NDV Media, we want to thank our listeners this evening and give our appreciation to those of you who may be joining us later via podcast, iTunes, etc. So we'll see you guys in 2 weeks with a new topic for discussion Wednesday, August 18th, 11 p.m., right here on blogtalkradio.com. We'd also like to give a shout-out to other NDB Media shows coming up over the next couple of weeks. First, Thursday, Travel Itch Radio on the 22nd. No, not on the 22nd. Pardon me. That's going to be tomorrow on the 5th at 8 p.m. Eastern Time. Nothing pleases adventure travel writer Linda Ballou more than seeing gorgeous country from the back of a good horse. Her articles have appeared in Equus, Horse Illustrated, California Riding Magazine, and numerous travel publications. Lost Angel Walkabout is a collection of travel essays about her most meaningful adventures. Her new adult novel, The Cowgirl Jumped Over the Moon, travels from the Grand Prix jumping circuit to the High Sierras. Embrace of the Wild, her latest, was inspired by the life of equestrian explorer Isabella Bird and covers territory that ranges from the life-affirming Hawaiian Islands and to the majesty of the Rocky Mountains. How does a travel journalist translate her talents into the book-length form? Find out on Thursday when Linda joins Travel Itch Radio for a half-hour discussion with Dan Schlossberg and Mary Ellen Nugent Lee. This coming Saturday, Sports Talk with the Guys, Saturday morning extravaganza, 9 a.m. The Monday morning quarterbacks are live on Saturday morning. on Sunday, the 22nd of the month, a couple weeks from now, 8:30 p.m. Eastern Time, The Walking Dead online viewing party returns with final Season 11, Episode 1 premiere, Asheron Part 1. And yes, the following week will be Asheron Part 2. Returning to Alexandria from a critical food mission, the group realizes it isn't enough. Maggie proposes a new plan, potentially a suicide mission. Please join us online and on the air by phone for real-time discussions, updates, trivia, profiles on the cast and crew, and more. Monday, 10 p.m., Monday Night in America, Roger D. Noriega brings you his unique take on politics, current events, entertainment, sci-fi, and history. Followed by The Nightmare Hunter with Roger Noriega, Tuesdays at 10 p.m. on Streamlabs. Tuesdays at 10 p.m. here is Fandom Access Week in Review. Join the terrific trio of Jamie, Karen, and AJ as they dig into another night of TV. Please look for The Rock and Roll Shrink on Facebook, on Twitter, on iTunes, and on the web at www.rockandrollshrink.com. Thank you, everybody, for joining us. We will see you next time. And rock on. Good night, everybody.